This is why I would like MMT people to adopt Minsky, because the fundamental inside of MMT, which is that, you know, the government doesn't tax to spend, it spends to tax. Government spending and excessive taxation creates money. That is absolutely 100% based on the accounting, and Minsky is the ultimate system for doing integrated double entry bookkeeping accounts. So once you set it out that way, it's bleedingly obvious that MMT is correct about government money creation. And forget about all the arguments and nuances. Anybody who doesn't understand that doesn't understand accounting.
Welcome to Activist MMT, a podcast about real-world economics, including modern money theory, and how life changes when you discover it. I'm your host, Jeff Epstein. Today I talk with post-Keynesian economist Steve Keen about his decades-long fight against mainstream economics, what MMT convinced him of, and the couple of parts of MMT he still disagrees with. This first part is a half-hour-long audio interview, which will be followed next month by an hour-and-a-half-long video interview, where Steve walks me through the basics of his Minsky modeling software and why he believes it's an important tool for MMTers. MMT and Steve are in complete agreement with how banks spend. They lend money into existence. After reading Stephanie Kelton's book in 2020, Steve realized that government spending also creates money. National governments don't tax in order to spend, they spend in order to tax. Steve quickly created a Minsky model, convincing himself that MMT is indeed correct regarding this. This insight is also completely compatible with his understanding of bank spending. As far as Steve's disagreements with MMT, they are important, and Steve lays them out in detail in the last 10 or so minutes of this episode. But let it be known that they are far from core issues. In other words, the amount of agreement is far greater. It's good to understand what these disagreements are, but as Steve says, we have much bigger fish to fry. This is the first main episode of Activist MMT since August. Although I've released three chapters from John Harvey's reading of his book Contending Perspectives, with lots more to come, the past 6 months have been all-consuming, starting with my third Torrens course, which was coincidentally taught by John on that very book. It was both incredibly enlightening and unbelievably exhausting. I've also become a full-time musician. I now sing several times each week at retirement communities and related facilities, independent living, assisted living, nursing homes, etc. Coincidentally, back in July, I met Steve in person for dinner in Princeton, New Jersey, which is about an hour north of my home. After dinner and conversation, Steve gave me an initial walkthrough of Minsky. We ended the night with me singing a few songs on the sidewalk, just me, my phone, and a little Bluetooth speaker. At the very end of today's episode, after the closing theme music, you'll hear a small highlight from that experience. You can check out my singing website at cjeffsing.com. That's SEEJEFFSING.com. And now, on to my conversation with Steve Keen. Enjoy.
Good to see you again. How are you?
Fine. Can you actually see me, by the way, or is it just basically voice?
No, just that was just a figure of speech. I would like to talk for like 30 minutes, and then we'll switch to video.
That's fine. Sure.
Okay. So my plan is I don't want to do any like introduction, whatever. I'm just assuming people know you.
Mm-hmm.
What I would like to do is just take like the first 20 minutes of just summarize your, you know, your own journey to MMT. You know, obviously you were fighting mainstream for a long time, but your journey to basically your journey to MMT. It doesn't have to be precisely that, but you know, roughly.
Okay.
In the last 10 minutes, I'd like to, you know, I'm nowhere near a position to defend anything, but just as I understand it, you have two strong disagreements with MMT. And I'd like to just briefly summarize those and then ask a follow up and then we'll get into Minsky on
yeah, video. Sure. Okay. Yep.
So go for it. If you are, I presume that you're probably pretty ready to talk about that. So, you know, I think it's safe to say that you agree with the vast majority of what it says, and we'll get into the disagreements later.
Yeah, yeah. Look, I've always been a non-orthodox economist, right from my halfway through my first year at university at the age of 18 in 1971 in Sydney University. And at that point, I realized I was being conned by the textbooks, courtesy of a brilliant lecturer who explained the theory of the second best to me right in the first year. And learning at that stage, it just put a complete hole through the neoclassical vision. So from that point on, I was decidedly non-neoclassical. And that's when I'm the age of 18. I then led a student revolt at Sydney University over the teaching of economics. I wasn't the only one involved, obviously. There were three major personalities involved in sort of the leadership group, but about 70 or so activists fighting the department with the sympathetic support of probably about 80% of the student body. So they then established a Department of Political Economy. I didn't continue on as an academic. I spent about 10 years working in various unusual roles. So I was a school teacher for all of 8 months before I kicked the English master out of the library one day, and then became education officer at an aid organization called Freedom from Hunger. Spent about 2 or 3 years working on international media and journalism after that. Conference organization, computer programming, ended up working in a government body involved with trade union policy, and then realized that everything I was doing in the public service was being blocked by neoclassical economists. So I went back to university to study economics and do a master's and PhD. And through the whole period, I've been reading a range of economic material. And the first thing that made sense to me in terms of analysis of capitalism was Hyman Minsky's financial instability hypothesis, in terms of the financial side anyway. And I then did my PhD on that. And I combined that with Richard Goodwin's work on the cyclical nature of capitalism, the predator-prey model that he put together, which was in itself an expression of a model that Marx dreamt up in the first volume of Capital.
Credit to what?
Sorry?
You said credit to what was the phases of capitalism? Credit to something?
Oh, well, predator-prey. No, the...
Predator-prey.
Yeah. There's quite a strange passage. And like volume one of Capital is entirely set as if money is gold. Not because Marx believed that money was gold, because he deliberately... that was supposed to be the first volume of 6 books. He never wrote the other 5, of course. But in the first one, he was maintaining the simplification that money was gold, therefore there was no financial components to his analysis in volume one of Capital. There were in volume two and volume three, but not in volume one. And he also assumed that workers get paid a subsistence wage. Now, in chapter 25, volume one, there's a little section where he goes off in a little discussion about cycles in wage levels, which drops the assumption that wage is a constant and always equal to subsistence. And Richard Goodwin saw that and understood it as an analogy, the way that Marx argued it, to a predator-prey system. And he then built his model of a cyclical system of capitalism, but it didn't have money in it. And having read Minsky and read Goodwin, I thought, well, as is my PhD topic, I would combine the two. So I did that. And what I got was Minsky's financial instability hypothesis as part of my explanation for the crises of capitalism. And money was implicitly a part of that, but it wasn't explicitly a part of that. And so what I spent the next 13 years or so doing was working out how to bring model money properly, and working from Graziani's logic on the what they call the circuit theory of capitalism, I finally started building what became Minsky. And that became, it started off as single entry bookkeeping, it became double entry. And at that point, I realized the importance of understanding double entry to understand money. So I had built that foundation. I was quite comfortable in modeling credit money dynamics, but I hadn't particularly paid attention to government money. I was quite sympathetic with the overall position of MMT because as part of my model, I had the government spending could stop the economy falling into a debt deflation. So, you know, I was certainly always in arguing in favor of deficits. And but what I hadn't worked out, and this is just because of lack of attention, is what actually creates money from the government side. So private banks create money by loans create deposits. Deposits are part of the money supply, so loans create money. And that's quite straightforward to model in Minsky. But working, you know, fighting the neoclassicals who don't understand the role of credit at all and understand money at all, that's what I predominantly focused upon right up till about 2019 or thereabouts. And I've forgotten when Stephanie published The Deficit Myth. So when? 2018? Yeah, okay.
Forgive me. 2020. The politician, the young lady politician in New York. That's when.
Oh, MMT. Okay. Yeah.
Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah. So like nothing in the deficit myth was a surprise to me, except the argument that the deficit itself created money. Because whenever, I hadn't really thought about it carefully. There's so much else in neoclassical economics to fight, you know, and so much to build an alternative. This wasn't an area I'd focused on until then. But Stephanie said the deficit itself creates money. And I thought, well, I'll model this in Minsky. And sure enough, that's exactly the case. If the government spends more than a take back in taxation, then that is the act which creates money. In the same sense that when a private bank creates money, it does so by boosting loans, which are an asset of the banking sector, and boosting deposits, which are a liability. The government, when it spends, boosts reserves, which are an asset of the banking sector, and boosts deposits. So the increase in reserves and increase in deposits go together in the same way the increase in loans and increase in deposits goes together for private money creation. And then, the bonds. Yeah, sorry?
Well, finish what you're about to say, but I want to ask, but how do you distinguish between the government creates money when it deficit spends? I know that's not the greatest term, but when they have a deficit that creates money, as opposed to they've collected taxes and purchased bonds or whatever you call it, lending bonds, and then use that money to spend in deficit. How do you distinguish the difference in the model to know that it's actually creating money as opposed to reusing the tax money?
Well, I can actually show that in Minsky later when we go video. But the beauty of Minsky, and one thing I always found awkward about MMT is lumping the central bank and the treasury together. I thought that was clumsy. And I can understand it as an intellectual device to avoid having to talk about the internal government dynamics. But with Minsky, it's extremely easy to do that. In fact, it's easier to separate the treasury and the central bank than it is to put them together. But once I did that, you have the Treasury, which decides to spend, either decides or is forced by circumstances to spend more than it takes back in taxation. That then means that if it did that without selling bonds, then its account at the central bank would go negative because governments don't allow, by legislative reasons only, don't allow that account to go negative. It therefore issues bonds. The sale of those bonds enables what they call the consolidated revenue fund at the Treasury to remain positive or at least not negative. And those bonds are purchased by the reserves that were created by the deficit. And I can put a whole model together literally where you start off with like zero in every account and then show that the government spends more than it takes back in taxation. It creates the reserves. It creates assets for the central bank as well as the central bank buys bonds equivalent to the interest on the existing outstanding government debt, inverted commas, which, as Stephanie said, is not really a debt at all. So to find an action in a double entry system which creates money, you have to find something which occurs on both the asset and the liability side of the banker's ledger. Because if things happen just on the asset side, then it's an asset swap. If things happen just on the liability side, it's a liability swap. So you need an action which occurs on both the liabilities and the asset side. And in the case of banks creating money by creating debt, they push up their assets by you know, getting a borrower to agree to a loan, they push up their liabilities by putting the money in the deposited account equivalent to that loan. So that occurs on both the asset side and the liability side. And exactly the same thing applies to running the so-called deficit, which I prefer to call fiat these days, by the way, just to get away from the nonsense of associating it with running out of money. It's actually creating money, as MMT argues. So this deficit, I'll call the deficit for the sake of conversation. Spending more than you get back in taxation increases bank accounts by the deficit. It also increases the assets, the reserve, by the same amount. Now, no other operation in that treasury side of things does that. The central bank, if the central bank sells bank bonds to or buys them back from non-banks, that occurs on both sides of the ledger as well. But the sale by the treasury of bonds to private banks and the primary dealers, that occurs just on the asset side of the bankers, the banking system. So there's no creation of money out of that. Equally, if the central bank buys bonds off the primary dealers or the banks or sells them to it, that is also an asset swap. And that has no role in money creation. So just simply on a logical basis, you must have an operation. We're talking double entry. There are two entries to create or destroy money. Those operations have to occur on one has to occur on the asset side, the other on the liability side. And that's a very simple logical way to decide whether something does or does not create or destroy money.
Okay, so I have a question. So you were focused on the banks, you weren't as focused on governments, and then Stephanie's book came out. And so what was the transition between, what did you think beforehand? How confident were you that regarding your view of the government, you partially didn't look at it, but you must have created something in your mind. Did you think, well, I had to not create money or something like that? And then and how long was the transition between that and being convinced, you're creating the Minsky model? Like, was that a very quick transition or what?
Between 25 and 30 seconds.
Okay.
That's long. I'll lay out a table in Minsky when we do the video side of this, but it literally is that fast. So if I was asked beforehand, and you'll find some podcast with myself and Phil Dobby where I say this, Phil had asked, does government spending create money? And I would say, to the extent to which the central bank buys bonds off the private banks, which was, I hadn't really thought about it. That was my basic answer, and it was wrong. So as soon as I laid it out in a set of Minsky tables, obviously my previous supposition was wrong, and it was obvious that Stephanie's logic was right. And then at that point, in terms of the agreement with me becoming an MMT-er in the sense of accepting its argument about how the government creates money, that was instantaneous.
But how long was the transition? I mean, you had original thoughts, but you weren't confident about them. And then from that point, you decided, I need to look into this. Like, what was from that point until the point that the model was quick to create, but how long was the actual transition of your realizing that maybe your thoughts need to be evaluated to being convinced about MMT?
25 seconds.
That's that. Okay. All right.
When you lay it out, this is why I would like MMT people to adopt Minsky, because the fundamental inside of MMT, which is that, the government doesn't tax to spend, it spends to tax. Government spending and excessive taxation creates money. That is absolutely 100% based on the accounting. And Minsky is the ultimate system for doing integrated double entry bookkeeping accounts. So once you set it out that way, it's bleedingly obvious that MMT is correct about government money creation. Forget about all the arguments and nuances. Anybody who doesn't understand that doesn't understand accounting.
Okay. So before we go to the criticism part, we have a few minutes left. What were there any other insights aside from government spending creates money that MMT revealed to you?
No.
Okay. Okay. So all your banking stuff is pretty already compatible with MMT.
Already compatible. And that's like I see people like Noah Smith and people like that saying MMT doesn't have an analysis of money. Well, bullshit. Private money. The neoclassical don't have analysis of either. And in that sense, the MMT analysis of government money creation is 100% compatible with my analysis of private money creation. And you can easily see the nuances in the two systems. And we live in a a world with a mixed credit and fiat system. And because it's based, they're both based on double entry bookkeeping, Minsky is an engine for double entry bookkeeping, so they're 100% compatible.
Okay, great. So let's switch. Got about 12 minutes. I'm not going to even dare to refute or anything of what you say. I just want you to summarize the two, as I understand it, two major disagreements that you have with MMT. It's obviously not related to government spending, not related to bank spending. And then this is was inspired by and partially the wording by a patron of mine named Mano. I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly. Did you model these disagreements in Minsky and therefore remain convinced that these two things are wrong?
Well, the main one, you better say what they are. I mean, obviously,
okay,
one
of
the
two that I understand is number one, that MMT says that exports are a cost and imports are a benefit because you want to focus on the real stuff as opposed to the money. And you had a massive debate with Warren, I'm thinking 2018, that I watched before I really understood, but I just knew that I was watching something important, although I didn't understand a word of it. So that's one, is exports being a cost, imports being a benefit. And this one, I don't quite understand. I'm just going to read what they said. Mano said, you are of the view that exports increase the money supply in the exporting country, which helps increase aggregate demand.
Yeah. Okay. Well, look, I was stunned by that argument from Warren. You'd think he might pick it up in the discussion because I just thought, I thought it contradicted the basic ideas of MMT. And it also ignores the role of growth over investment over time. The exports are a cost and imports are a benefit argues you give a piece of paper to somebody else and they give you an object back and you come out ahead because they've got a piece of paper and you've got an object. That is entirely static thinking. I've even seen Bill Mitchell argue that there's an opportunity cost. The country giving you their goods in return for your pieces of paper is suffering an opportunity cost because they could have used the thing they gave you domestically, and now they've got less productive resources in their own country. And I think that's some of the, pardon me, but it's the most naive nonsense I've heard in a long time. It's the sort of thing I'd expect of a bunch of neoclassical economists because the whole idea that it's an opportunity cost for a start ignores what we know on post-Keynesian economics, which is that virtually all firms have constant marginal costs and falling average fixed costs and have excess capacity, which isn't being, because it's excess capacity is something you install because you expect to, everybody invests with the expectation to take over more of the market than they actually do manage to take over. You have to have excess capacity to be able to respond to any slips by competitors. You're not doing price competition, you're doing non-price competition. So you hope your model car will take over at the expense of other people's models of cars. So what you get is unused capacity. And if you can use exports to fill a part of that capacity, then you increase your revenue. You can invest more, you can grow more rapidly. And what you get out of that is, on paper, and that's a bit of a pun, on paper, you're giving away a physical thing and getting back a piece of paper. But what you're doing is using more of your physical capacity, getting more investment funds, enabling you to invest and grow more rapidly. And therefore, in a very superficial sense, yes, you're giving away an object for a piece of paper, which I think is, pardon me, it's childish. What you need to expand your productive capacity is more investment revenue. You've increased your retained earnings. You will be able to invest more and grow more rapidly. And what you get out of that is that countries that run a trade surplus and export more than they import tend to be the ones that invest more and grow more rapidly over time. And that's, if you look at the data, if imports are a cost and exports are a benefit, then America would be a very wealthy place and China would be in poverty. And, China's gone forwards and America's gone backwards in the last 40 years because America's run a trade deficit, which it fundamentally has to because it's an international reserve currency. China has exported and grown dramatically. So I see, first of all, the foundation arguments, I think, are just wrong, silly, and somebody should have told Warren he got that one wrong. Secondly, if you look at the data, the argument would be that countries running an export surplus would be worse off than ones that are running a export deficit, and that's manifestly not the case. The countries that have industrialized successfully have exported more than they've imported. So that, you know, that's breaching MMT's idea about what's a good idea and succeeding because of it. And if MMT was correct about this, then where is the policy to restrain trade deficits? Because if it was true that a country running a deficit actually benefited, then, of course, unless we manage to export to Mars, the sum of all exports is zero. And if one country is benefiting by running a deficit and therefore effectively harming other countries by doing it, then you need international rules to restrain that. Now, I don't hear that being said. So what I see on that front is just a load of waffle that I think is a waste of time, and I wish that particular one to be kicked in the garbage bin and stick with what is correct, which is the role of governments in creating money.
Okay. Actually, the other disagreement, which I just remembered, and I don't want to get too into this, job guarantee. I don't know this for sure. I haven't heard you say this directly, but I've heard others say that you're not quite on board regarding the MMT prescription of the job guarantee.
Okay, I'm not against the job guarantee by any means. I think a job guarantee is a very sensible idea because at the moment the workers are the ones who pay for the ups and downs of capitalism, and that just shouldn't be the way things are. So a job guarantee is a sensible idea, but I think it should be paired with the universal basic income. And this is where I think I've got people think, oh, no, job guarantee good, universal basic income bad. I think they're complements to each other. And I think partially the attitude, and again, a lot of the stuff I think comes out of MMT having originated in America. It doesn't only apply to America, but originated there. You guys have got a dreadful social security system. Countries in Europe have a pretty good social security system, though it's been damaged by the euro. And Australia at one point had a very good social security system as well, damaged by neoliberalism. So the countries outside America took the idea of basic social service, you know, basic social services for granted. We, before neoliberalism fucked everything up, we had decent pensions, we had decent healthcare. And so we didn't see the need for saying, you know, we've got to get the services before the basic income because we already had the services. So what I've always thought of in terms of is a universal basic income, the universal basic services. So health is covered, education is covered, all the things which happened in my youth in Australia would be expected. So and every nation made sure that its citizens had basic health care, necessary health care, and necessary education. And that's just taken for granted, then you would have a universal basic income on top of that, and then a job guarantee on top of that again. So I don't see them as being incompatible, and I find the extent to which MMT people attack people who are talking any afraid of a review UBI as being an unnecessary fight.
Okay, so Ed, and I'm not confident about this, and we have to be, you know, we don't have the time to make sure that all of our definitions are exactly compatible with each other. So this is a little bit of a dangerous question, but my understanding is that the difficulty or the danger of the UBI is that it undermines the price anchor of the job guarantee. The job guarantee, the major point of the job guarantee is price stability. That's the price anchor. That's the major goal of the job guarantee. And that putting the UBI out there potentially undermines that price anchor, which eliminates the major benefit of the job guarantee. Can you just, respond to that?
I just disagree. Now, look, I think that's a bit of convoluted logic. If the UBI is there at a lower level than the job guarantee, which would be the sensible thing, you know, if you're going to be asked to get out and do work which you're directed to do rather than work what you wanted to, then you should be paid a higher wage. So the UBI would be below the job guarantee level anyway. And so if you're seeing that price stability is the advantage of the job guarantee, then that's setting a price level above the level of the UBI itself. And I rather think in terms of, you know, providing a fundamental standard of living for everybody, you can get more if you work, and you get more again if you work for a private employer, and more again if you become an entrepreneur and do useful stuff for society as a result of that. But I'm you know, I've seen too much poverty in my life, you know, to think about saying, well, you've got to get a job guarantee to get income in the first place. I would rather provide that universal basic income. And again, that was what Australia had a reasonable level of that with. It used to have unemployment benefits, which were of the order of 25% of the average wage. They've fallen well below that level, and I would rather have, you know, the three tiers rather than just the two.
Okay, that's fair. And the fact that it's lower, the fact that the UBI would be lower than the job guarantee definitely makes it easier, a little bit easier to swallow. I will be honest, you know, definitely from a much less educated point of view, I would be honest and say that I'm still skeptical of that and need to know a lot more about that. But we're not going to go more into that right now. But let me, my final question regarding this, both the job guarantee, UBI job guarantee, and the exports being a benefit, have you modeled your and either of these views to whatever is possible in Minsky?
No, because I just don't have time. I mean, particularly when 2019 or earlier, when they discovered the garbage neoclassical economists doing on climate change, that's my first and foremost focus. And when I have a bit of spare time, I put time into MMT issues. But fundamentally, the main thing I'm warning about is the ecological crisis coming our way, courtesy of being led by morons, which is the neoclassicals are dangerous morons. And I want to warn people about the damage they're doing, the potential survival of human civilization. And, you know, therefore, I don't really have time to do the other modeling I'd like to do on MMT and exports versus imports and so on.
Okay, excellent. All right, well, let's transition to video.
Okay.
I'm going to give you, I've never tried video in here. I wonder if I should take that chance. Why don't we give it a try? Let's give it a try. If after a couple of minutes we're uncomfortable, then we'll switch to something else. I have a backup. But I'm going to stop this and I will send you a link if a different link needs to be sent. Just check your email. All right, talk in a minute.
Okay. Do I shut this down or what do I do?
Don't do anything. I'm going to stop.
So, okay, so what's going to happen?
What's going to happen?
What's going to happen? Yeah, like in the next 30 seconds.
We did a barter transaction.
There you go. That's right. It's bartering. Yeah.
You gave me a very significant walkthrough of Minsky.
Mm-hmm.
And you are paying me by listening to five songs.
There you go. Okay.
Today I talk with post-Keynesian economist Steve Keen about his decades-long fight against mainstream economics, what MMT convinced him of, and the couple of parts of MMT he still disagrees with. This first part is a half-hour-long audio interview, which will be followed next month by an hour-and-a-half-long video interview, where Steve walks me through the basics of his Minsky modeling software and why he believes it's an important tool for MMTers. MMT and Steve are in complete agreement with how banks spend. They lend money into existence. After reading Stephanie Kelton's book in 2020, Steve realized that government spending also creates money. National governments don't tax in order to spend, they spend in order to tax. Steve quickly created a Minsky model, convincing himself that MMT is indeed correct regarding this. This insight is also completely compatible with his understanding of bank spending. As far as Steve's disagreements with MMT, they are important, and Steve lays them out in detail in the last 10 or so minutes of this episode. But let it be known that they are far from core issues. In other words, the amount of agreement is far greater. It's good to understand what these disagreements are, but as Steve says, we have much bigger fish to fry. This is the first main episode of Activist MMT since August. Although I've released three chapters from John Harvey's reading of his book Contending Perspectives, with lots more to come, the past 6 months have been all-consuming, starting with my third Torrens course, which was coincidentally taught by John on that very book. It was both incredibly enlightening and unbelievably exhausting. I've also become a full-time musician. I now sing several times each week at retirement communities and related facilities, independent living, assisted living, nursing homes, etc. Coincidentally, back in July, I met Steve in person for dinner in Princeton, New Jersey, which is about an hour north of my home. After dinner and conversation, Steve gave me an initial walkthrough of Minsky. We ended the night with me singing a few songs on the sidewalk, just me, my phone, and a little Bluetooth speaker. At the very end of today's episode, after the closing theme music, you'll hear a small highlight from that experience. You can check out my singing website at cjeffsing.com. That's SEEJEFFSING.com. And now, on to my conversation with Steve Keen. Enjoy.